And it is a special privilege that you take time out in your busy schedule. I know your seat is probably tired. And to have us share together. And I don't take this opportunity lightly, because I know that you've prayed about being here and that you're here at God's appointment. And that gives me a secure feeling, because I know that there's no accident or nothing that's accidental or incidental with God. So let's just be asking the Lord to have our hearts open. I've often thought they've got these conferences all mixed up, though, as far as Colorado weather is concerned, haven't they? You really ought to be free in the morning and have your meetings all afternoon, because we just have such beautiful mornings, and it's cloudy up there now. I hope we get a little rain. Recently, I met a friend that I hadn't seen for quite some time. The last time I saw her, she was an open, happy, outgoing individual. I was shocked when I met her this time to find an angry, judgmental, critical, bitter person. As we talked, I discovered that following a second marriage, her husband's of a few months, her husband's supervisor, had bitterly and viciously verbally attacked her in front of her husband, and he had not opened his mouth in her defense. She was totally bitter. That same week, I met a man, or I met another friend, who had just turned 40, was over his head in debt, a debt which he felt he'd never be rid of, feeling defeated because he was feeling that the Lord was not using him and could not use him, and probably never could use him, had contemplated suicide in recent days, and he was totally discouraged. That same week, Jack and I were invited to speak at a marriage seminar where a very young Christian, a Christian about of a year, had wanted with all his heart to present some Christian help to vacation couples. So he had sent out over 30,000 pieces of literature advertising the seminar to vacationers at a large resort, advertised widely in TV and radio and through the newspaper, and ended up with two couples and a few residents attending the seminar. He was very tempted to lose heart. At the same time Jack and I finished the seminar, we came back to some monumental problems, very frustrating things at work, and Jack was tempted just to grow weary with it all. Very diverse and complex problems, but one common solution. The solution is found in Hebrews 12. Then I'm going to read from the Living. The second verse says, "Keep your eyes on Jesus, our leader and instructor. He was willing to die a shameful death on the cross because of the joy he knew would be his afterwards. Now he sits in the place of honor by the throne of God. If you want to keep from becoming faint-hearted and weary, think about him." So this afternoon, I'd like to just consider Jesus and see how, in considering him, he can be the answer to the diverse kind of problems that I just described. First of all, we need to consider him because he never makes mistakes. He never makes mistakes. When we first came with the Navigators, Jack
took an assignment to be a service center director in Long Beach, California. He'd never been in the service. We'd never run a navigator home. We knew nothing about nothing. And yet we were thrown into a situation that was way too big for us and very good for us because it made us fall on our knees before God. A few months into this assignment, Jack was asked to take a 3.5-week trip with his supervisor around the U.S. It was the first time that we'd ever really been separated for more than a few days in our marriage, and I wasn't looking forward to it. But to provide for my lonesomeness, I decided that I'd go back and visit my parents in the Midwest, who I hadn't seen them for a couple of years. And they had set money out for Christmas just for me to be able to make this trip, and I was really excited about it. About 3 weeks before Jack was to go and I was to go, Jack took me up in the hills of San Pedro in the car one afternoon. And we parked, looking out at the beautiful harbor, and he said, honey, what would you think about not going home while I was gone? And I said, oh, well, I wouldn't think much of it. And he said, well, my supervisor feels that it would be a very bad thing for both of us to be gone from the center and the home at the same time, and he wants you to stay home. Well, I sat there and cried all afternoon. And I thought, I was not crying because I was unhappy. I was crying because I was mad. Did you ever do that? And I was furious. I wasn't furious at Jack because I knew he had no choice. But I was furious at his supervisor. And inside me I was saying, he has no right to tell me what to do. I'm no good here. Of course, I told Jack all this. I said, I don't know what to do and to manage the service men's center. We don't know. I would be totally helpless. I'm no good here without you. Why should I stay? And so I raged inside and cried outside. But the fact is, I knew I was going to have to stay home. I thought temporarily of just defying Jack and defying his supervisor and defying the whole mess, but I was afraid to. I was afraid because I was afraid to be out of the will of God. And I didn't know what God's will was in the situation, but I knew it wasn't to defy Jack and the supervisor. So I got back to my room, and I prayed. And I realized that I had two choices. I could stay and get bitter and angry and be totally frustrated the whole 3.5 weeks. Or I could stay and learn what God wanted me to learn from that situation. Well, I got enough brains up here to realize that the latter is really the easiest course to take. So I said, all right, Lord. Whatever it is you want, I want it too. Well, it turned out to be a delightful 3.5 weeks. 3.5 weeks of really learning from God some deep lessons about himself, of letting him delight my heart. And then later, about 3 or 4 months later, when I was able to take the trip, I discovered that my mother had been in the hospital during the time that I was going to go originally. My daddy had not told me because he wanted to spare me worry, but I would have not been able to visit her. Also, at the time I was able to go, I got to go to a wedding that was very special to me to get to go to. Got to come back through here and attend a conference that was a learning experience and a delight to my heart. As I looked back on it, I realized that God makes no mistakes. He makes no mistakes. However, the lid had to be nailed down on that lesson. One of the lessons that God was trying to teach me at this time was that I needed to hold my husband with an open hand. That my husband does not belong to me. He belongs to God. And I do not own him. He's loaned to me of God. And because of that, I have to hold him loosely. I hadn't quite learned it all yet. And so we had planned a day off, and days off were rare. in that particular situation. And we had planned that on Tuesday, the only day that looked like it would be available after he got back, that we would have some time to ourselves. And if that supervisor didn't call Monday night and call an all-day meeting for Tuesday, and Jack had to be there. And again, you know, you would think by this time I would say, okay, Lord, whatever you want. But I guess I'm a hard learner in some of these things. And I had to go again to the Lord and say, Lord, what are you trying to teach me? And the Lord had to again say, Carol, is your husband really mine? Is his time mine? And I'd say yes. And so we went to that all-day meeting on Tuesday. But you know, God was not withholding my husband. It isn't that he doesn't want me to spend time with my husband. It's that he wants to conform me to his image. And so in a beautiful way, he opened up in just a miraculous way, really, 2 days later, a time for us to spend all day together. And you know, it was especially delightful because of what we learned. But in looking back on that, I realized that I wasn't really mad at Jack's supervisor. I was really mad at God. Because I knew that God makes no mistakes. God could have changed that supervisor's heart. He could have fouled up the whole trip and not let Jack go. He could have done one of 10 things. And so I had to admit that I was really mad at God. My friend had to admit the same thing. You know, forgiveness is hard. But if we really believe that God makes no mistakes, if we're really considering him, then she had to realize that God could have struck that man that viciously attacked her in a verbal way. He could have struck him dumb, couldn't he? He could have wiped him out, wiped him off the face of the earth. He could have given her husband backbone enough to stand up in a ticklish situation and fight for my friend. What did she need? Well, she needs a lot of grace, doesn't she? Because this is not an easy one. This is a toughie. When you really are hurt deeply because of what someone has done, to forgive costs. And she needs to consider what Christ did for us in order to be able to forgive. Let me read you something I came across just on forgiveness, which is quite beautiful. This is from a little book called Cherishable, Love, Cherishable or Marriageable by David Augsburger. He says forgiveness is hard, especially in a marriage teeming with past troubles, tormented by fears of rejection and humiliation, and torn by suspicion and distrust. Forgiveness hurts, especially when it must be extended to a husband or wife who doesn't deserve it, who hasn't earned it, who may misuse it. It hurts to forgive. Forgiveness costs, especially in marriage when it means accepting instead of demanding repayment for the wrong done, where it means releasing the other instead of exacting revenge, where it means reaching out in love instead of relishing resentments. It costs to forgive. What is forgiveness? Stated legally, forgiveness takes place when the injured party drops charges, cancels his suit for damages, and himself absorbs the loss incurred by the injurer. When a man is wronged by another, either the party who was injured, the first party, forces the second party to pay, that is justice, or else the first party accepts the injury done and sets the second party free, that is forgiveness. Stated psychologically, forgiveness takes place when the person who is offended and justly angered by the offender bears his own anger and lets the other go free. Anger cannot be ignored. I think this is an important point, too. Anger cannot be ignored, denied, or forgotten without doing treachery. Lots of times we try to suppress anger, don't we? We try to ignore it. We try to pretend it never exists. And this is a very wrong way to handle anger. But he goes on to say, it must be dealt with responsibly, honestly, in a decisive act of the will. Either the injured and justifiably angry person vents his feeling on the other in retaliation, that is, an attempt at achieving justice as accuser, judge, and hangman all in one, or the injured person may choose to accept his angry feelings, bear the burden of them personally, find release through confession and prayer, and set the other person free. That is forgiveness. Stated practically, forgiveness takes place when the man hurt, sneered, betrayed, or cheated accepts the loss and pays the cost of forgiving the other's wrongs, asking for no repayment, seeking no revenge, holding no resentment. Repayment for most injuries is impossible. Revenge boomerangs on the revenger. Resentment sours the soul. Oh, I wish we could remember that. Only forgiveness can bring healing and reconciliation. Forgiveness takes place when we say to the man who puts us down, you're okay with me again. Justice would say, you're not okay, you pay. Forgiveness says, God loves me, so I'm okay. He loves you too. As far as I'm concerned, you're okay. We're okay. And finally, stated theologically, forgiveness, whether human or divine, is essentially substitutional. It is vicarious. No man truly forgives his brother until he bears upon himself the hurt of the other's deed. God forgave us in Jesus because God was in Christ paying the cost of forgiving men by bearing the total hurt of our evil upon himself at Calvary. And then he paraphrases 1 Peter 2:21 to 24 this way. Follow in his forgiving steps. He was unjustly assaulted. He did not repay with insult. He was evilly abused. He did not retaliate with threats. He trusted justice to the one who judges justly. He accepted the cost of forgiving, carried all our sins with him to execution. He paid the cost of forgiveness in full. So we are free through forgiveness. If we accept it by ceasing our evil, if we receive it by living for righteousness, he paid in forgiving the cost of our healing. The answer to bitterness, according to Hebrews 12:15, where it says, we must look diligently, lest we fail to obtain the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble us, and thereby many be defiled. We obtain forgiveness. We get rid of bitterness by obtaining the grace of God. But how do you obtain the grace of God? Well, by asking, by seeking it, by considering him, fixing your eyes on Jesus. It's the only way I know to really rid ourselves of this terrible octopus whose tentacles wrap themselves around every facet of our being called bitterness. What about you? Is there something in your life that you really haven't forgiven? And therefore you're being judgmental and critical? Do you need to forgive someone? Are you willing to pay that price of bearing it upon yourself, bearing the hurt yourself? Another thing that we need to consider about him is the fact that he is preparing us for heaven. Consider the fact that he is preparing us for heaven. You see, as I talked to that man, my friend who felt like a total failure, the answer for him, as well as for my friend that was bitter, was to consider Jesus, who is preparing us for heaven. Let me ask you a hard question. Are you willing to be considered a failure in the eyes of people all your life for him? In order to really be prepared, if that's what it meant? That's a hard one, isn't it? I was faced with that question one time. And it wasn't, I didn't get any peace about it until I fell on my face before God and said, God, I am willing to be considered a total failure in the eyes of people. If that is what you have in your long-range plan for me, for your glory. It took some doing for the Lord to make me say that. And the circumstances are too great to tell you. But it was worth it. When Lynn started high school, our daughter, our only daughter, the counselor got all the kids together, the students together, and gave them this sage advice. He said, you who are going into a college major, my advice to you is that you take the easiest courses possible. He said that the reason for that was that in your entrance into college, all the college looks at is the grades. Not what you take, but the grades. And therefore, if you want to get into good schools, take the easiest course possible. I went to this man afterwards, and I said, what happens when kids do that, what you suggested? Supposing they take all the easy courses, and then they get to college, and sure, they make it, but then they're faced with college courses. What happens? And he kind of nodded, and he said, well, about half of them flunk out. The logic to that escaped me. So Lynn and I talked it over. Lynn and Jack and I talked it over, and she decided that she would take the courses that she needed to take to learn to study, to prepare, not for college, but for life. She decided to take the long-range view. You know, God has a long-range view for us. He is fitting us to reign with Him. Mm-hmm. This life is preparation. That's all it is, really. Oh, He will use us, hopefully, in small ways. But He is fitting us to reign with Him forever. This is this much of our lives that we get our sights set on. And all that, as far as you can see and further, is eternity. Oh, that we would see from God's viewpoint, huh? To fix our eyes on Him so that we can see this life from God's perspective. It's absolutely necessary as we struggle sometimes with the lessons down here. You know, you've all wondered, and I have too, why it seems that some people are always under it. From the Lord. You know, I know people that my heart just bleeds for them at the things that they've gone through. And it seems like forever. And then others of us, sometimes I look at myself and I think, Carol, you really don't have any trials at all. And then I look back and I realize, oh yes, there have been quite a few. But seemingly, in comparison, I really don't have. From other people's vantage point anyway. Well, I think of that as someone having a double E major in college, you know, two engineering degrees, which is a tough, tough major. But they're taking it, why? To prepare for something that is tough when they graduate. And then someone over here who knows they want to be a homemaker all their life, they'll take all the home ec courses, and that's right. But it's easier, huh? For most of us. Two courses, and God has a separate course for every single one of us. We've got to keep our eyes fixed on Him. Humanly speaking, when I'm asked that question, am I prepared to be a failure in the eyes of other people? Humanly speaking, I say no. But when I fix my eyes on Jesus, as that man needed to do, I can say yes. A little poem from a book called Tell Me Again, Lord, I Forgot, says this. Today she came for a lesson, a dear little girl with a trace of impatience salting her words. I don't like these exercises. I want to play beautiful music. I've said this to you. I said to her then, "This is the way to learn beautiful music. I am your teacher. Trust me and see." Lord, I thought of the times you've said this to me. And then we need to consider him, because he is training us. And he's training us for two reasons. He's training us in order to make life better for us. In verse 9 in the Living, it says, so that we can really begin to live. So that we can really begin to live. All of us want to have life on a higher plane, here and now, I mean, to make life better and to make us better. And he says this in verse 10, but God's correction is always right, for our best good, that we should share his holiness. And, of course, this was the answer to both the fellow who put all this effort out in this seminar, 30,000 pieces of literature for two couples, and he was very tempted to lose heart. And it's also the answer to Jack coming back to face some monumental problems. He was tempted to lose heart, to be frustrated, to be discouraged. But if we can consider Jesus and consider the fact that God allows these things in our lives to make life better and to make us better, then we can kind of relax, can't we? And say, okay, Lord, I don't understand it all, and right now I really don't like it. But thank you, because I know you're doing it for my good. And, of course, in this chapter in Hebrews, it says, at the moment, all discipline seems painful. You know, it doesn't seem pleasant. But afterward, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness, one translation says. Well, what hinders us from considering him? One of the things that hinders us from considering him is the fact that we're looking in the wrong direction. Instead of looking at him, we're usually looking here, right at ourselves. At least I am. I don't know how many times my mother has said, Carol, the world's worst indoor sport is self-pity. And so every time I'm tempted to feel sorry for myself, I think, okay, now, Carol, this is the world's worst indoor sport. Let's not indulge. But often I find when I get discouraged, when I get despondent, when I get weary, when I'm tempted to lose heart, as this translation says, it's because I'm looking at me rather than looking at Jesus and fixing my eyes on him. Or I can look at other people. I am a great one to compare. And, of course, we always compare ourselves negatively, or almost always. I guess the other kind is just as bad when we compare ourselves and then get proud about it. Maybe we can always find somebody that's a little worse at something. But usually I compare myself negatively. And I think, oh, why aren't I a lady? You know, I'm one of these women who, it seems to me, I am always opening my mouth only to change feet. You know how that is? I talk too much. I pray. I say, Lord, guard my lips. And I have to. I have to pray that a lot. And I say, Lord, make my mouth a well of life. And then I forget to pray and I do it again. So I look at someone who never seems to say the wrong thing at the wrong time, who is my idea of a lady. And I think, Lord, how come you didn't make me like that? Or I see someone who sews beautifully. You know, I'm very lucky if I can sew on a button. And I think, how come you didn't give me talent like that? Or I hear somebody singing just beautifully. And I kind of sing in the cracks. Not on the white notes or the black notes, you know, but in the cracks. And I think, Lord, how come you didn't let me sing? I really love music. I'm always comparing myself negatively. One thing, good thing I read on that was just try practicing the no-knock policy. You know, just promise God and yourself that you will never knock anybody, including yourself. And so every time you start to say, oh, I am so stupid, just ask the Lord to stop you from knocking yourself. He created you. He loves you just the way you are. Oh, I don't mean we don't all have some rough edges that he's perfected. Of course he is. We want him to. But he created you with a personality, the character that he wants you to have. And it's beautiful in his sight. And you have a very special spot in this world for him. So I'm tempted to look at others, and therefore I'm not fixing my eyes on Jesus. Or I look at circumstances. And I kind of get like Peter when he was walking on the water towards the Lord. And you know, the minute he took his eyes off the Lord and looked at the giant waves of circumstance, what happened? Started to sink. And sometimes I do this and I find myself falling flat on my face and kind of groveling in the mud down there. And I can't see anything but the mud, the circumstances. You know what the answer is? Same thing that Peter did. Help, Lord. Help, Lord. And the Lord reaches down and picks us up. Says, of course I'll help. Now, fix your eyes on me. So, looking somewhere else sometimes blocks our view and hinders us from looking at him. We can have our eyes blocked completely, like a curtain that falls down, because of our own anger, our own bitterness, as in my friend's case, our own discouragement and frustration. Any of these things can become like a curtain that blocks us from really seeing him. And of course, what's the answer to that? Help, Lord. Confession. Show me what it is. Do you ever have just a total lack of desire to look at Jesus? I'm sure you all have. I have. And you know there's something wrong, but you don't know what it is. And so you've gone to the Lord, and not because you wanted to, because you made yourself. And you've said, Lord, what is it? What's blocking my joy? What's blocking my vision from you? I don't have the feeling of your presence. Well, let me give you a suggestion when that happens. Of course, first of all, pray Psalm 139, 23 and 24.